Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Frank Sinatra became a singing sensation as a very young man, but his background and even his looks made him an unlikely star. Still, he changed the world of popular music with his image, with his publicity machine, and mostly, however, with his voice. Today on All Sides, we're going to talk with James Kaplan. He's the novelist and the writer for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and many other magazines. James has co-authored autobiographical memoirs with John McEnroe and Jerry Lewis. Frank, The Voice, is his first biography. Welcome to the show, James.
Delighted to be here, Anne. Thank you so much for having me.
In your acknowledgement at the end of the book, you said the origin of the biography was a dinner in Santa Monica in 2004 where you discovered that everyone present except you had known Sinatra. Feeling a little intimidated there or what?
Well, not only known Sinatra, but worked with him.
Okay.
It was a bunch of musicians working on Jerry Lewis's Labor Day telethon. Mm. And little did I know, we went out to dinner at an Italian restaurant in Santa Monica, and we ate a lot, and we drank a lot, and we all got very jolly. And it turned out these guys had all worked with Sinatra, and I kind of, knowing musicians as I do, they tend to be rather direct people, say what's on their mind. I sort of inwardly expected the gossip to begin about women and mob and the mob and fist fights, and and instead, every one of these guys spoke in tones of awe about what an absolute musical genius this man, who could not read a note of music, by the way, was. And I was almost taken aback by this. I was very moved because while I guess on some level knew this about Sinatra, it wasn't somehow what I expected to hear.
It's pretty shocking the impact. Even when I go on YouTube, you know, last night just cruising through YouTube and listening to all kinds of his music, the comments underneath from the 15-year-old girls saying they don't make music like this anymore.
Yeah, yeah. A couple of years ago, I was picking up my then 11-year-old son at school one afternoon. I happened to have Sinatra on the radio, which I don't all the time, but I did that day. And he got in the car, and I was sort of fooling around, and I said, Avery, you know who that is singing on the radio? And he said, duh, Dad, that's Frank Sinatra. He's unmistakable.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was it daunting, you know, as exhibited at that dinner party that night, everybody there knew him, they'd worked with him, there were still lots of people alive who knew him and worked with him. Was it daunting to write your first biography about not only such an important subject, but about one who was so well known so many people still around to critique it?
Yes, 1,000 times. Yes, I was continuously daunted in the process of writing this book by many factors. One of which is that Sinatra is more written about than practically any other cultural historical figure of modern times that you can mention. There are just dozens upon dozens of biographies about him, let alone the many other different kinds of books about Sinatra. And who was I, as you said, this is my first biography, to presume taking this guy on?
More written about than almost anybody. So what could you write about? What did you feel that you brought to the table with this biography?
I thought that I looked at the other biographies, and I felt as though very often what was in the foreground was what I expected that night from the musicians. The scandal, the squalor, the women, the mob, the fistfights. I felt that with a couple of the most prominent or famous biographies anyway of Sinatra, that you practically didn't know that this guy had ever sung a note. So I thought, well, I have to write another book. I'm finishing this book with Jerry Lewis. My publisher wants me to do another book. This is wonderful. I want a big subject, a subject I feel engaged with, involved in. Here is Frank Sinatra, who is a gigantic figure. What about the idea of trying to put the genius on the page? And what about doing a book not of virtual contempt, which a lot of these gossipy books feel like, but a book of empathy about Sinatra?
The empathy seemed to extend to the tone. Sometimes I felt like there was a tone about it. There was some of the verbiage, some of the lexicon felt back in the 30s or the 40s?
Sure. I wanted to do a different book. I wanted to do a non-academic biography. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do, this is a much larger than life figure. I wanted to do a lyrical book about a lyrical subject. And I decided in my presumption to try and do a biography in a different key, to try and do a different kind of biography. And yes, I very often was using a voice that was consonant with the time of which I was writing and the subject I was writing about.
Well, let's get to some Frank Sinatra music.
Yeah.
Let's listen to There Are Such Things. It's Frank Sinatra's first recording in 1940 with Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra. Sinatra is vocalist with a group that includes Joe Stafford and the Pied Pipers.
Someone to whisper, darling, you're my guiding star. Not caring what you own, but just what you are.
You know, James, we just moved to FM frequency yesterday, and we couldn't have done it in more of the nick of time to listen to that, because that music must be heard in a better modulated way. And it's I'd never heard that before I prepared for this show.
Well, and notice a couple of things. I don't want to be too pointy outy, but I can't help it where Sinatra's concerned. Notice the exquisite diction. Mm-hmm. Notice when he says whisper, it's not just whisper as most people say it, but it's, he almost puts the H before the W. It's whisper. And notice too that he is singing in perfect accord with the Pied Pipers. That was as the great Joe Stafford herself, who I was so fortunate to speak with before we lost her, pointed out to me, not every big band singer had the gift of being able to sing with a group and to become part of the group. Sinatra was the featured singer on the Dorsey Band, and the Pied Pipers were just backups, but Sinatra, when he sang with them, became a Pied Piper.
At the beginning, I guess we could start a little bit at the beginning and go back a little bit. Frank, he did have a difficult birth. He had a kind of a tough childhood, partly not because he was impoverished in any way, but his mother was something of a force of nature. Dolly Sinatra, Natalina Garaventa.
Natalina Garaventa, mm-hmm. Yes. Her relatives are still around in Hoboken. I spoke to a couple of them just a few weeks back. She was a force of nature. She was tiny, under 5 feet tall. She was fiery, volcanic temper, volcanically ambitious, too, for herself and for her family. She was politically very passionate. She was a suffragist, once chained herself to a fence in 1919 so women could get the vote. She was a political Democrat. She became a ward boss in Hoboken. She also worked she made her living, really, as a midwife and an abortionist. She made a lot of money doing those things. Abortionist, of course, was against the law, and she got arrested a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But she was very ambitious for her family. She moved them out of the Italian-American tenement in Hoboken to nicer and nicer places. And because Frank Sinatra was such a difficult, he was 13 and a half pounds at birth. It was a terrible delivery, forceps delivery. His face was scarred, and I think both mother and child were emotionally and physically scarred by that delivery. He was an only child, which was an extreme rarity in those days. So there you have an only child in blue-collar Hoboken, New Jersey, with a mother who's making good money, living in a nice place. He had his own bedroom, his own radio. He liked to give out in later years that he had kind of been a street kid running with the gangs. That was a fabrication. He was kind of a little Lord Fauntleroy.
In a Slate.com book club chat about your book I was reading, one writer says that you hint at but ultimately underplay Sinatra's other major unfulfilled romance with his emotionally absent father. Now, I hadn't thought of it as an unfulfilled romance, but I did sense a light touch in that regard. His father almost seemed to emerge in relief, or, you know, in base relief to his mother.
Yes. Well, his mother was an extremely strong character. This is a pattern that repeats itself in a number of families, and oddly enough, often with people who become prominent. The mother was a driving force behind Sinatra, and by the way, highly unpredictable emotionally. He said that he never knew whether she was going to hug him or hit him, which certainly lent a dynamism to his personality, let's put it that way. His father was, I might as well put a fine point on it, he was a weak man. He was very much in the background. He never really spoke much. He was a fireman in Hoboken. Dolly got him the job, by the way, through her political connections. He was content to go to the firehouse, sit around with his buddies, have a drink and a good time. Not the sharpest tool in the shed, whereas Dolly Sinatra was. She was the sharpest tool in the shed. She could speak every dialect of Italian. She was a brilliant woman, and Frank Sinatra inherited her brilliance. Didn't inherit much from his father except for his looks and the passionate need to find father figures in his young manhood.
Now, 3 years after that 1940 recording, Frank Sinatra is lead singer and a star. Here's Sinatra singing Take Me with Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra.
Take me, I'm yours, if you will take me. I want you to make me a part of your heart. And hold me, I dreamed you would hold me. Now really enfold me, say we'll never part.
James Kaplan, a lot of people think that this, he sort of reached this, at that time, pinnacle overnight.
Oh, boy, he used to laugh about that. Mm-hmm. He, like most so-called overnight successes, Sinatra worked his behind off and suffered through years of obscurity or comparative obscurity before he got hired by Harry James, the great band leader. Well, he was a great trumpeter and he was a great personality, not such a great band leader because his band fell apart. That was when Sinatra got hired by Tommy Dorsey, and he labored with Dorsey for 3 years as he came to prominence. But it was all a very gradual climb. And by the way, very different from the career of Billie Holiday, who Sinatra idolized and was virtually the same age as Sinatra and became very famous as soon as she was discovered by John Hammond of Columbia Records.
We have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with James Kaplan, author of Frank the Voice, a biography of Frank Sinatra. Stay with us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the London Olympics. They kick off in 1 month. We'll go to London and to the athletes preparing to compete. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. 80 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunny and hot today, warming up to a high of 88. Clear skies tonight, a low of 64. Sunshine for Thursday, another hot day, a high of 99 degrees.
Support for 89.7 comes from Picnic with the Pops. The Columbus Symphony celebrates the 4th of July and our city's bicentennial with the annual Patriotic Pops, Saturday, June 30th at their new location, the Columbus Commons. Tickets at picnicwiththepops.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is James Kaplan. He's written a book about Frank Sinatra. It's called Frank the Voice. I remember the first song that really hit me, you know, that I remembered as a conscious human being was, I think, Something Stupid. And Frank Sinatra left Tommy Dorsey's band in 1942 to go solo. And you talk a lot about Dorsey and others as father figures. The father figure was a big thing to Sinatra. Why did he leave? And why was it unusual for a singer to go out on his own at that time?
Well, it was the era of the big bands. And in those days, the what they called the boy singer or the girl singer with the band was a secondary feature. The star of the band, the star of that band was the band leader, was Tommy Dorsey playing the trombone or Harry James the trumpet or Benny Goodman or Artie Shaw playing the clarinet. Those were the stars. But something happened when Sinatra was singing during his tenure with Dorsey, and that was that in an era where suddenly you had this huge demographic group of teenagers and mainly teenage girls who suddenly had a couple of nickels to rub together, some disposable income, they could afford to buy records. Sinatra mania arose. The girls began flocking to the Dorsey concerts to hear Sinatra sing. They crowded to the front of the stage and they screamed, they swooned. Dorsey made fun of them at first. He had his musicians pretend to scream and swoon back at the girls, but before he knew it, the cart was leading the horse, and instead of Dorsey's being the star, Frank Sinatra was the star, and it didn't matter. You know, father figures, I guess, are, as Freud would have us know, made to be overthrown. It didn't matter that Dorsey was the father figure and Sinatra's idol in a lot of ways. Sinatra knew it was time to go out on his own.
The reaction of those teenage girls, the Bobby Soxers, to his performances was amazing. I think it was in Time magazine, a reference in 1943 said, "Not since the days of Valentino has America womanhood made such unabashed public love to an entertainer." They just swooned and screamed, as you said. What was it about Frank Sinatra?
Well, the first thing, and this was Elvis mania a dozen years before Elvis, and
right.
Beatlemania 20 years before the Beatles. The first thing is the voice. The voice was extraordinary, and this was, you know, I say in the book that the male voice is extremely important. It's an extremely, it's a key sexual attractant to women, and there was something magical about Sinatra's voice and something magical about the way he conveyed a song and conveyed his own vulnerability. He was canny enough as an artist and as a singer to realize that this vulnerability was something that really reached out and grabbed women, and so he emphasized it. It was not only the vocal vulnerability, it was his physical vulnerability. He looked like he needed a good meal. He was about 127 pounds. He was skinny. He had those electric blue eyes, an incredible stage presence, and the sense of assurance mingled with that sense of vulnerability was absolutely combustible.
When he went solo, he went into the movies as well. Let's listen to Frank Sinatra singing "I Fall in Love Too Easily" from the 1945 movie musical Anchors Away. Sinatra and Gene Kelly played sailors on a four-day leave in Hollywood, and amid all the song and dance numbers, Sinatra was given this beautiful ballad.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard for love to ever last.
Now, in this song, I'm starting to hear the Frank Sinatra that I'm familiar with.
You're also hearing very naked autobiography there. He did fall in love too easily and too fast. Yes, you are hearing a more familiar-sounding Frank Sinatra. His career was one of continuous artistic and vocal evolution. And the Sinatra of the yearning ballads of the 1940s was evolving in the mid-40s and then in the late-40s through some extreme life difficulties and artistic difficulties and business difficulties, evolving into the more mature baritone that feels more familiar to many listeners.
This was his first significant movie role. Tell us how that came about.
Well, he appeared in a few movies with the Dorsey Band, but they were really just featured artists in B movies. When Sinatra went solo, he signed a contract with RKO Pictures and made a movie called Higher and Higher, which was a cute sort of fluffy B picture, silly comedy in which he played himself. Something happened soon after he signed with RKO in 1943. Louis B. Mayer, the great head of the great MGM, heard Sinatra singing at a benefit in L.A. and said, "I must have that boy." And so he signed Sinatra. He stole him away from RKO to the greatest studio in Hollywood, MGM, and Sinatra for several years thereafter was singing and dancing frequently alongside Gene Kelly, frequently in a sailor suit, and it became a role that America loved him in, but a role that very quickly began to chafe Sinatra.
He was cast as a naive sailor, bashful. That was the way it was for a while for him.
Yes, he was. He played early on a character named Clarence Doolittle, who was the bashful with women. Say this for his acting skills. He brought it off.
he was
saddled with that. He was almost typecast in that bashful role for a few years. He was really eager to get out and become a serious actor.
Let's talk about the women thing. Let's just get it out there. There are some parts of the book where you start describing a day in the life of, and it's dizzying.
Yes.
What his, you know, how many intimate relationships he had.
Yes, he said.
If you want to call it that.
Yes. Well, it's a nice euphemism. he said in later years. He joked in a lecture one time that he said, if I had had as many lady friends as you guys, meaning the journalists, a tribute to me, I'd be in a jar in Harvard Medical School. Well, you know, the fact is, I think there were more. Listen, the women started coming at him. This was, as I said, Elvis before Elvis, the Beatles before the Beatles. It was mass hysteria. It was mainly on the part of adolescent females, but older women too. They started coming at him from the beginning of his career. He gratefully accepted all comers, and there were thousands. While he was a married man, by the way.
You know, partly, well, we haven't even gotten to her yet either. There's not enough time in the day. The swooning and the screaming and that sort of thing, it wasn't completely natural. Some of it was...
It was sweetened.
Bought and paid for.
It was
sweetened.
It was
okay,
sweetened.
There's a euphemism.
Bought and paid for is a harsh way of putting it. You know, when Sinatra went out on his own, he hired the greatest publicist of his time, George Evans, who took a look at Sinatra. First, he was skeptical, but then he saw Sinatra in action at the Paramount in New York, and he thought, "Wow, I've got something here." George Evans saw and heard the girls screaming and swooning at Sinatra, and he thought, well, this is great, but the problem is that the main thing about Sinatra is his voice. They're drowning it out. So he thought, if I can orchestrate this, I really have something. What he did was he would hire a cadre of girls, 20 or 25, to give them crisp $5 bills and coach them precisely on when to scream, the loud parts of the song, when to shut up, the quiet emotional parts of the song, and the other girls in the auditoriums would follow suit. And so it wasn't exactly an artificial phenomenon at all. It was something that had existed. George Evans just took control of it.
Also, let's hear some more music. In 1945, just before the end of World War II, Frank Sinatra starred in an RKO movie, short playing himself as a singing star who observes a gang of boys bullying a Jewish boy. Sinatra earnestly reasons with them about diversity and tolerance and then sings the title song, "The House I Live In."
What is America to me? A name, a map, or a flag I see, a certain word, democracy. What is America to me?
Again, a very interesting theme in his life about what America was to him. He was a very tolerant person.
He was. It was bred in him from the beginning. He was an Italian-American, growing up as an Italian-American in the 20s and 30s, at a time when Italian-Americans were very low in the social order. He always felt that chip on his shoulder about being Italian-American, and so that combined with inheriting his mother's democratic, big D democratic tendencies, made him for many years, until he went Republican in the late 60s, a dyed-in-the-wool liberal and Democrat with genuinely strong feelings of tolerance toward minorities. And the house I live in was a wonderful crystallization of his feelings about tolerance. And by the way, it was total show business, but mm-hmm. he really meant it. He really felt it.
It won an honorary Academy Award and a Golden Globe.
Yes.
Had great significance in his life and career because that was a song that was played to youth, American youth.
Yes, and you know what? You watch that short today. I would recommend it to anybody if you can get a hold of it. 15 minutes. It holds up. It's a message that it may look a little corny and old fashioned and 1940s-ish, but it's something we could all stand to pay more attention to.
Let's talk about his wife and his own family. There's his wife Nancy, Big Nancy.
Yes, they were married in 1939 His career with Harry James was about to begin. The women were coming at him then. They were to continue to come at him. I think that Nancy Sinatra, who, by the way, is still alive today at age 93, was a very smart woman. And I think that early on she made a kind of bargain with herself. She felt she would countenance it as long as he came home to her. But after a while, the infidelities, and especially as Frank began to step out with more public figures like Lana Turner, especially, mm-hmm. The infidelities just became too flagrant. Once the national press began taking note of them and publishing pictures of Sinatra with other women, it just got too much for Nancy Sinatra.
They call her Big Nancy because their first child was born in 1940, also Nancy, called Little Nancy.
Yes, Frank's partner on Something Stupid, also known as the incest song. They're singing a love song to each other, Frank and his daughter.
That's right.
Yeah.
Frank Jr., who some people liken, you know, his voice to his father's.
It's very similar. It's a very similar voice. It's a very tough life that he has led. Sinatra, I think, I know that he was absent for most of the childhoods of his three children, but I think that it was easier for his daughters than for his son. Imagine being not only a son, but a son with the same name as that father and walking in that shadow. It's been very tough.
When reference to that song or the song, The House I Live In, popped up, or maybe it was veiled reference, I can't remember now, but when he started hanging around with the perceived gangsters, the organized crime figures, that kind of a thing, one of the things that the media and one columnist in particular threw up at him was that you're not such a goody two-shoes. Here he is preaching to the country's children about how to be a good kid, and look who he's hanging around with.
Absolutely. He did hang around with those guys. And he idolized those men. Again, he was an Italian-American, and many of the mobsters he hung out with. And let's also not forget that nightclubs used to be a major component of American culture. The clubs were run by the mob. So any entertainer who worked in a club willy-nilly consorted with mobsters. But Sinatra went farther. He, as an Italian-American, idolized these guys. He, the way a small boy idolizes cowboys, he saw them as tough guys, as men of strength and honor. He went much too far with them and continued to do so his entire life. But it was really people ask all the time, was Sinatra mobbed up? Did he take the oath? Did he burn the image of the Madonna in his hand? Did he prick his finger? No, this is all nonsense. He just spent too much time admiring these people, and they were bad, bad people.
What about the character in the Mario Puzo novel, The Godfather? What about that with the horse head?
Yes, there are two powerful. Listen, The Godfather is it's a terrific book, and it is, and the Godfather movies, apart from Godfather 3, are great, great movies, great works of art. But they're works of art; they are fiction. The character, the singer Johnny Fontaine in The Godfather, makes an interesting comparison to Sinatra, but in a parallel universe. And the two main myths, and I call them myths, of The Godfather, have to do with Johnny Fontaine's leaving the band leader, Les Halley, clearly based on Tommy Dorsey, and the gun being put to Les Halley's head by the Godfather. And then, of course, the horse's head in the bed of the movie producer that got Johnny Fontaine the big movie role. I would say there's much more truth to the Tommy Dorsey-like story. I think there was indeed probably some mob pressure on Dorsey to let Sinatra go. But as far as the role in From Here to Eternity that sealed the greatest comeback, because Sinatra's career had literally, it was on life support. It had died in the late 1940s, early 50s. And when he played that great role in From Here to Eternity and then won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar, that was the most amazing show business comeback of all time. Sinatra got that role not through any mob intervention at all, but surprisingly enough, largely through Ava Gardner.
His next wife.
Yes, his next wife, who went to Harry Cohn, the head of Columbia Pictures. And this was, Sinatra was still widely perceived at that point, not only as a showbiz failure, but also as a guy who at his peak had been a sort of singing, dancing star. For he was a hoofer and a singer for MGM. He wasn't a serious actor, but, and that's how Harry Cohn of Columbia Pictures, which was producing From Here to Eternity, saw Sinatra. But Ava Gardner went to him, the most beautiful woman in 100 years, and Harry Cohn was quite the lech, went to him and said, if you give Frank a screen test, I'll give you a free picture. And Harry Cohn looked Ava Gardner up and down and thought, well, what else could I get for free here? And he gave Sinatra the shot, and Sinatra nailed that screen test.
We're going to hear more from that movie, From Here to Eternity. It was made in 1953. Frank Sinatra played a character called Angelo Maggio. We'll get to that when we come back from our break. My guest is James Kaplan. He's biographer of Frank Sinatra. His book is Frank, the Voice. We have an email from Debbie. She says, my favorite Frankie song is I'm a Fool to Want You. She asks, didn't he actually write that one?
He got a writing credit on that song. For this reason, it was one of the only songs he ever recorded that he did in one take. It was at a time when his marriage to Ava Gardner was in the process of breaking up. He was devastated. She had another boyfriend, a bullfighter in Spain. He was falling apart. He went in. He recorded that song in one take. And improvised a couple of lines in the song. The writers were present, and they gave him a writing credit on the song.
We'll take that break now. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, why flying is no fun anymore and may be getting more dangerous. Aviation writer William McGee says airlines' cost-cutting hasn't just added fees and hassles. He says airplane maintenance is being outsourced to foreign companies where some workers can't read manuals for equipment they're working on. His book is Attention All Passengers. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 81 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine and a high of 88 today, possibly near 90. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 64. Sunshine on Thursday and another warm day, a high near 99. Partly cloudy Thursday night, a low of 75.
Support for 89.7 comes from OSU's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More information at glenn.osu.edu.
If you contributed to 89.7 NPR News this year, thank you. Your support provides for the highest quality news and information. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and we're close to our goal, but we still need to hear from you. If you wish to make a gift, visit us online at WOSU.org or call 866-897-9678. Thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to join All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow. Beginning at 10, we will have special coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on the health care overhaul. Join us for special coverage from All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow, beginning at 10. And now All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is James Kaplan. He's the biographer of Frank Sinatra. His book, Frank, The Voice. Here's a clip from the 1953 movie we were talking about earlier, From Here to Eternity. In this scene, Private Angelo Maggio, played by Frank Sinatra, interrupts a conversation between his buddy, played by Montgomery Clift, and his girlfriend, a dance hall girl, played by Donna Reed.
I didn't hear those sounds of combat, so I thought you might want a drink.
You've been hogging the whiskey, Angelo.
Not me, buddy. It's Sandra. She's a nice girl, but she drinks like a fish.
Keep pouring. Keep pouring.
No, thanks. I don't drink. I think it's a weakness.
I grant you that.
I don't like weakness. Do you?
No, I don't like weakness, but I like to drink. Hey, what are you gonna do? Marry this guy? You're grinning at him like you're his wife.
Get out of here.
Okay, I'm gone. Back to old long-legged Sandra. I love him tall. Acres and acres.
That was a great scene. There was one part element of that scene where he throws the drink up. Yeah. throws the drink out and says, hope there's not a cop under that. Talk about his experience making From Here to Eternity. He said Gene Kelly was his mentor in musical comedies and that Montgomery Clift was his mentor as a serious actor.
Well, this was Sinatra's first serious role, and he took it very, very seriously. Fred Zinnemann, who directed this wonderful movie, and I recommend anybody who hasn't seen it to watch it. It really does hold up. It's a terrific picture. Said that Sinatra, who, by the way, theretofore in Hollywood, had a very bad reputation. He had a nickname, One Take Charlie, was what they called him. When he made records, he took as many takes as it took, but when he made movies, one take was all a director got with Sinatra, not on From Here to Eternity. He worked incredibly hard. It was his first serious role. He wanted to make an impression. He wanted to win the Oscar, and he saw in Montgomery Clift the acting equivalent of the artist that Sinatra himself was. He saw that Montgomery Clift was a kind of genius, and he not only watched him very carefully, but sought his advice on how to play the role. And Montgomery Clift gave Sinatra very good advice, most of which had to do with quietness, with playing it down, with movie acting being done with the eyes and not so much with big gestures.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch of his life, he was a somewhat tempestuous fellow. He could be sort of grouchy with people.
To say the least. Yeah,
to say you called him one take. You mentioned the idea about the one take, but that was if he showed up.
Yes.
To the film studios.
Yes, when he showed up. There was a movie he did called It Happened in Brooklyn in the middle 40s where he was frequently absent. He was frequently absent because uh, he was he was conducting an affair with an actress named Marilyn Maxwell. He's very high-handed about showing up or not showing up on the set, and he was roundly disliked for it. He had throughout his life he made his own rules, and it didn't. He had a sense of his own importance that was second to nobody's. It didn't make him a lot of friends. Those who admired him had to be his idolaters, but there were many who didn't.
Maybe that includes our next caller, Frank from Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us your story about Frank Sinatra.
First of all, my first introduction to him was his album Music for Swingin' Lovers. There was a song on that called Come Fly With Me.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I love that album. I still have a copy of it in Monoral somewhere. Anyway, I was living in Hollywood, Beverly Hills area, working in a restaurant called Stefanino's. And the host of that restaurant was Nicky Blair, who went on to open his own place in Las Vegas under that name.
Mm.
Anyway, I was the pasta and vegetable cook there.
Hmm.
And Frank Sinatra came in one night, ordered fettuccine Alfredo, which I made, and he sent it back claiming that the noodles were overcooked. And the chef was so upset, he fired me.
Wow.
I overcooked Frank Sinatra's noodles.
Oh, man.
It's a great memory. It's a great memory for a great man.
It was worth losing the job over a little bit, huh?
Yeah, it was. There were other jobs, but there was only one Stefanino's and one Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, and it's a great story, too.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for your call. My guest is James Kaplan. We're talking about his new book, Frank, The Voice. It's a biography of Frank Sinatra. Let's talk a little bit more about the movie, because it opened to rave reviews, including for Frank Sinatra. He won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, but he had to wait a long time before the Oscars came along that year. What was the impact on his career from this movie?
Well, the initial impact on his career, despite the rave reviews, was wait and see. You know, he got rave reviews when the movie came out in August of 1953. But from August of 1953, it was 7 months until the Oscars in 1954, and those were a rough 7 months. His marriage with Ava Gardner was really falling apart. They were about to be permanently split then. Not a lot of jobs were coming in, and it wasn't really until he won the Oscar in March that things turned around for him. He was singing with Capitol. He had been dropped by Columbia Records and picked up by Capitol for about $200, and he had been connected. He had been hooked up with this young unknown arranger named Nelson Riddle. He was making amazing records, but we should also not forget that Sinatra, in November of 1953, after the premiere of From Here to Eternity, well before the Oscars, and even as he was in the midst of making these wonderful records for Capitol, had a very serious suicide attempt.
Yeah.
because of his marriage breaking up.
What was the problem with their marriage?
Too much alike. They, too much alike. They were both volcanic characters, fiery tempers, and this was. It was the yin and yang of their relationship. It was what drew them together. It was what blew them apart. I compare them to an unstable chemical compound that could never bond. They were never going to be the couple who settled down and had kids behind a white picket fence. They had an enormous, it was really the thunderbolt in each of their lives, seeing the other. They had enormous sexual chemistry, but they also had enormous fights because they were both very, very strong-willed people, and as they were getting together, Sinatra's career was going downhill, and Ava Gardner's was shooting upwards, and very soon she became the breadwinner for the two of them, and that in that day and age and in that culture, that was and for Frank Sinatra, an Italian-American man of that vintage, a very, very uncomfortable thing.
I don't know why, but I was sort of happy to read in the book that, you know, in the end, I mean, about that time of From Here to Eternity, he had a pretty good relationship with his ex-wife.
He did throughout his life. You know, it was really a sweet relationship. I think that after the fireworks that destroyed their marriage after she changed the locks on their house and divorced
them. Well, that stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff.
The money, the... Yeah.
She never really... first of all, she never remarried mm-hmm. Anthony. I think she never fell out of love with him. And I think that he, for his part, loved her too. But it was just... It was not a passion of his life. He was a passionate man. And so they had a friendship, and I think I would theorize sometimes even more, that lasted for the rest of his life.
I love the scene when he's sitting down. They have dinner together. The kids are there. She provided a lot of stability for those kids.
She did. She provided a home and a household for those kids, and I think that their upbringing and their later development, you mainly see it in Tina, the youngest. It shows that they had her guiding them.
Let's go back just a few years and talk about how his voice and his ability to identify with a song evolved over time. As a young singer, Frank Sinatra looked up to Bing Crosby. The song "Life Is So Peculiar," with music by Jimmy Van Heusen, was written for a 1950 Bing Crosby movie titled Mr. Music, and he sang it, and then Frank Sinatra came along later. Do you want to listen to it first and then chat about that?
Love to, sure.
Okay.
Life is so peculiar. A fork belongs with a knife.
Just a rumor that's having a rip.
Corned beef is lost without cabbage.
They're in love.
A husband should have a wife if he's married. Life is so peculiar, but as everybody says, that's life. L-I-F-E. Ladies and gentlemen, that's life.
Is so peculiar, a fork belongs with a knife. Corned beef is lost without cabbage. A husband should have a wife. Life is so peculiar, but as everybody says, that's life.
That's life.
Big difference.
Yeah, a big difference. And how about hearing Sinatra singing That's Life about 20 years before he sang That's Life?
Right.
But, yes, there you have the great Crosby and the great Sinatra. And, you know, Bing was born in 1903, 12 years before Frank. Frank, as a boy, there in his room by himself with his radio, heard Bing Crosby and was knocked out by this amazing voice. Bing Crosby was a great popular singer. Crosby was a revolution in popular singing. Male popular singers in the 30s were very fake sounding, very sort of high toned and artificial sounding. Bing Crosby sounded like a real guy, made every man listening to him feel he could sing like Bing Crosby. Well, the vast majority of men were sadly mistaken, but Sinatra was somebody who listened and thought, I can sing as well as that, and actually turned out to be able to.
There was a lot of talk about how he could dramatize a song just without a lot of histrionics, but just the way, I don't know, the shape of his lips or something. The way
Frank,
he could,
you mean.
Frank, yes.
Yes. Well, his life was drama, and that drama found its way into all his music. Of course, particularly the ballads, particularly the torch songs. But the big surprise of doing this book for me was how incredibly hard he worked on his singing, on every aspect of it: breath control, diction. He studied the lyrics to his songs passionately, deeply. He read the lyric like a poem before he ever sang a note of the song. And so by the time he actually did sing that song, if he loved that lyric, and he loved most of the lyrics he sang, he knew it very well. He was really communicating that lyric in a way that most other singers weren't able to do.
I guess all that said, I was surprised that he never learned to read music.
You know, I think that it's very hard. There are a lot of great examples of this. Louis Armstrong being a great example. A lot of musical geniuses, the genius just runs too fast ahead. Runs too quickly for the, I guess, the left side of the brain or whatever it is, to want to catch up and commit itself to book learning.
But he was a great reader. Or he tried to be a great reader.
I just mean, but the kind of learning that he would commit to study, to learn how to read music.
Exactly.
But yes, he was, and this is a big difference between Sinatra and Dean Martin, by the way. And Dean Martin, I admire greatly as a singer and as an artist, as an actor, as a comedian. But Dean Martin was always very ashamed of his lack of education and never more ambitious than reading a comic book or watching a Western on TV. Sinatra had that brilliance and that intellectual ambition he inherited from his mother, Dolly, and he read passionately his whole life.
In fact, he read the James Jones novel From Here to Eternity as soon as it was published. I mean, he knew all about the story.
Yes,
before.
And he found that wonderful character. It's a great book, by the way. I read it. Mm-hmm. It was one of the many books I read for doing my book, and it really holds up. It's a beautiful novel, a huge novel, a very powerful novel of the American Army before World War II on the eve of Pearl Harbor. And Sinatra found this little runty guy in the book, Private First Class Angelo Maggio, who was kind of the world's toy. He was constantly one down in the game of life, and at that point in Sinatra's own life, that's the way he felt. So he felt a very powerful identification with Maggio.
You know, you end the book with Frank Sinatra winning the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, and it's a sad sort of an ending in a way. Why did you decide to stop the book at that point?
It's a huge life and a huge career. I did 3 years of reading, research, and interviewing before I ever set pen to paper, and it quickly became apparent to me Sinatra had a 60-year career, and I defy you to think of any other entertainer who has either had or could have a 60-year career. His life touched on every aspect of America, American culture and history and politics in the 20th century. It just seemed like far too gigantic a life to enclose in one volume. And it also felt to me as though the early years of Sinatra, the young, skinny Sinatra with hair, the Sinatra whose art was forming, who was learning how to sing, who was scrambling his way up, that was a story that people didn't feel they knew quite as well as the story of Sinatra, the Ring-a-Ding-Ding Sinatra, the Vegas Sinatra of later years. And so it felt like a book in itself, and the Academy Award in March 54 felt to me like not a climax of Sinatra's life. He was so too impatient for that, but a kind of dynamic pause in that gigantic life.
So is there another book in the offing?
Not only in the offing, but commencing.
Okay. Well, good. Well, I hope to talk with you about that when that's ready.
Oh, well, I can't wait.
Okay. James Kaplan, a biographer of Frank Sinatra. The book is called Frank the Voice. James, thanks for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure, Ann. Thank you so much.
You bet. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, Columbus. And streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. Thanks for listening.